From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is scheduled to arrive in Las Vegas within the hour. Here he is speaking before boarding Marine One.
We're going to pay our respects and to see the police who have done really a fantastic job in a very short time.
By all accounts, the Las Vegas Metro Police response to Sunday night's shooting has been remarkable. In a press conference last night, officials released body cam video as officers crouched with concertgoers trying to help them while trying to spot the shooter. A warning, the sound is disturbing.
Hey, you guys, get down! Go that way! Get out of here! There's gunshots coming from over there! Go that way! Go that way!
As we said, it is disturbing, especially for the thousands who were there. David Holly, 26 years old, was at the festival with his girlfriend. He was shot in the elbow. A bullet grazed her head. He's at home in Victorville, California now, still in shock. And David, I can't even imagine what you do with the memories, but also, how's your arm?
I'm sore. I'm definitely sore. I'm working out with my work right now on how long I'm going to be out with from that.
You're a mechanic. You need that arm.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But as far as how do you live with it, there is no real way to live with it. I mean, the things you see, the things that happened, that's a good question. How do you live with it?
Yeah. Well, have you got an answer yet? I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah. So, like everybody, we hear you thought it was fireworks. Then suddenly you're just being, you know, shots are raining down. Talk about that, you know, nobody knew where they were coming from. As you're hit, your girlfriend's grazed. What are you thinking?
Honestly, I was in fight or flight mode. I was yelling at her to get undercover. I remember a person yelling for help that her husband or boyfriend had been shot. So I went in just into fight or flight, and I was trying to help him the best that I could. And just it seemed like the fire just kept getting worse and worse. And then once my girlfriend at the had told me that she had been shot, it was kind of the hardest decision I've ever had to make was, what do I do? Do I help her? Do I keep trying to help everybody else?
Yeah. And I'm assuming you were seeing some pretty terrible things with the people you were trying to help.
Exactly. I mean, I remember looking around, and when you just see bodies laying on the ground, not moving, it's a terrible feeling. Hmm.
But you do ultimately decide to leave. How did you get to the hospital? We're hearing about people piling into Ubers and pickup trucks and carrying people and fencing. How'd you get there?
We actually ended up running out of the venue. Once I felt like we were a safe distance away, I started trying to check her out, and I actually had two bystanders come and ask how we were doing and everything, and they saw me bleeding pretty well from the arm. So he actually bandaged me up, and he said, we need to get you guys to an ambulance. And at that point, I just begged him to get us to a hospital because of my girlfriend at the time.
Yeah. How is she? A shot grazing your head is no joke.
No, it isn't. And she's extremely lucky. I mean, I don't think you can get much luckier than that, but she's doing good.
So, again, we hear these stories of bystanders just coming up and helping you bandage. You get to the hospital. What was the scene at the hospital?
Chaos. Everybody was kind of freezing up. I even started trying to step in where I could on trying to help keep people calm. The staff was great. They did the best they could.
Do you have a bullet in your arm? Did you have a bullet removed from your arm? Did it go through? What happened?
For me, it was a through and through. It somehow missed my bone, but right now I do have nerve damage. I only have function of about three of my fingers right now. So hoping that we'll be able to get that repaired in the future.
Yeah, no kidding. Again, a mechanic. Look, 26, I just can't imagine you don't have friends and family that are out of their minds that you guys went through this.
Oh, I do. We do. We had my sister that flew out from Kentucky just to check on me. And, I mean, family was definitely worried.
Yeah.
I have had trouble sleeping so far. Every couple hours, I usually still wake up. I mean, I don't know. I honestly, I'm not one that's ever been saying, oh, I may have to go get help, but I don't know how to handle it.
Well, you know, you probably won't be the first one from this event to go get help. Do you think you will?
I think I'm probably going to have to talk to somebody about it.
Yeah. David, you know, as you said, you probably think you're both very, very lucky. But on the other hand, you have a terrible wound in your arm and these terrible memories. How are you processing that, that sort of one inch either way for either of you?
I mean, it's exactly that. I mean, I do feel very lucky. I mean, it's by the grace of God that I got out alive, that she got out alive. But, I mean, I guess I have that survivor's complex at the same time that I wish I could help more people. So I know there's a lot of people that didn't.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I did what I could, but I don't know. I have a lot to figure out still.
Yeah. It didn't end this week. David Holly, 26 years old, took a bullet to his arm in Las Vegas. He's now back home in Victorville, California. His girlfriend's head was grazed by a bullet. She's also recovering. We wish you both the best, David. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, people whose lives depend on dialysis are especially vulnerable during a hurricane. The machines that replace their kidneys need reliable electricity and water to operate. That's why 89 dialysis patients from St. Thomas had to be airlifted to Puerto Rico after Hurricane Irma, and then they had to be moved again to Miami when Hurricane Maria threatened Puerto Rico. WLRN's Sammy Mack has this story about the dialysis evacuees.
When Hurricane Irma slammed into the U.S. Virgin Islands, Alvin Joseph was home in St. Thomas with his wife, his oldest granddaughter, and four of his great-grandkids.
About 2:30 in the morning, my wife went in the little boy's bedroom, took out a mattress and a back spring. So when she called me, one of the ceiling tiles had already disappeared out of the roof, and we couldn't see the sky. By the time we left out of the bedroom to go back in the living room, whoosh, roof was gone.
The family survived the night, but not unscathed.
We had to go to the hospital with the oldest boy because one of the light fixtures fell out the roof and had cut him in the head.
So Joseph carefully navigated roads full of debris to get the boy to St. Thomas's only hospital. He was shocked when he got there.
So much structural damage was done to the hospital.
And that's when Joseph realized he had his own medical crisis to deal with.
Downstairs in the bottom floor where the dialysis center is, there was too much water leaking through the ceiling, so we couldn't be dialyzing the place.
Joseph has kidney disease. 18 years ago, he got his first kidney transplant, but that one failed after a decade. So he got another transplant, which didn't last as long. And then 2 years ago, he started dialysis at that hospital. 3 days a week, for about 4 hours at a time, Joseph would sit hooked to a machine that cleaned his blood. Irma upended that routine. Joseph is one of nearly 100 dialysis patients who were airlifted from St. Thomas to Puerto Rico. They received treatments there for a couple of weeks. Then Hurricane Maria came for Puerto Rico.
They told us that we was in a flood zone, so we had to leave, come to Miami.
For now, the dialysis patients are being housed at Florida International University.
We're going to make the plans for a long term.
Michael Christensen is one of the people in charge of handling the logistics of the dialysis evacuees. He's the director of market development for the dialysis company Fresenius Medical Care. The company runs and supplies dialysis clinics all over the world, including the one in St. Thomas. Fresenius recently finished construction on a brand new clinic just outside Miami and was about to start the certification process.
On average, it'll take about 90 days after we notify them that we're ready.
But with 89 new patients on their way to Miami, government regulators worked to get the clinic operational in under a week. Relocating dialysis patients in an emergency is a race against the clock. Missed appointments with the artificial kidney can quickly cause fluid buildups and organ damage. Several South Florida counties include dialysis representatives in their emergency response coalitions, but not all of them do. In many ways, the hurricane response for dialysis patients has been driven by dialysis providers.
It's a big logistical chessboard.
Kenny Gardner is a regional vice president with the DaVita Dialysis Company.
You know, the goal was to try to do as many treatments as possible that were going to be safe pre-storm.
Gardner says patients across Florida who evacuated were sent to clinics elsewhere. And the company hired fuel tankers to fill generators for its facilities and employees. DaVita operates a clinic in Key West. It's the only outpatient dialysis center in the Keys. After Hurricane Irma, the clinic closed for about a week. It wasn't damaged, and Gardner says the clinic was prepared to operate on generator power. Problem was, it couldn't reopen until it had a steady supply of clean water. Dialysis is a procedure that relies on osmosis between a person's blood and carefully titrated electrolyte fluids.
So that water, the fact that it's a big part of that component and interacting with their blood, becomes super critical.
The Keys Dialysis Clinic has since reopened. In Miami, Alvin Joseph says he's especially grateful to the volunteers who heard about the dialysis patients from St. Thomas and brought West Indian food.
Peas and rice, vegetables, kingfish, and stewed chicken. I'm not saying that the food that they're feeding us isn't well enough, but ain't nothing like a home-cooked meal. Yeah.
It could be a while before Joseph can go home. St. Thomas continues to reel from the effects of Irma. Early reports indicate it could be months before the only hospital on the island is fully operational again. For Here and Now, I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
Liberal advocate and filmmaker Michael Moore is wrapping up his one-man show on Broadway this month. It's called The Terms of My Surrender. It's a motivational speech for the left mixed in with stories about Moore's life. Special guests join Moore almost every night. The night we went, the guest was Whoopi Goldberg. Moore is known for documentaries like Roger and Me, Bowling for Columbine, and Fahrenheit 9/11, which became the highest-grossing documentary at the U.S. box office in history. I sat down with Michael Moore after his show last week and asked him, why Broadway?
Because Broadway, this theater is about 10, 12 blocks from Trump Tower. I wanted to come to the city that gave us Donald J. Trump. I live in Michigan, and we want to know just what happened here. You guys had 40 years in New York City. I don't know if you're from New York.
But I'm not from. I'm from the Midwest. Like,
oh, you are. Oh, yeah. Where are you from?
From Champaign-Urbana.
Champaign-Urbana. Oh, that's a wonderful place to go watch a losing football team.
for my whole life. Yep.
But look, New York is the capital of liberal America, and the liberal establishment and the Democratic Party has really failed much of us who live out there in the Midwest, in the Brexit states. And I wanted to come here and speak to the people of this area, and especially the people of I see every night in a Broadway theater, because we need them.
But some would wonder, why do you want to talk to those people? Are you preaching to the choir?
Yes, I am definitely preaching to this choir. This choir has been out running around doing the wrong kinds of things that have left us completely out of power. We're the majority of this country. The majority of Americans agree with us on all the issues. Name the issue, whether it's equal pay for women, climate change, gun control, death penalty. You know, the majority of Americans take the liberal position. And yet we hold no power as we sit here right now. We don't have the White House. We don't have the Senate, the House, the Supreme Court. 50 of our state capitals, the Democrats control only 6 of them. That is unacceptable considering that we are the majority of this country. So I am here to give the choir a song to sing. I am here to challenge people who work in liberal media, who work for the Democratic Party. I mean, so much good emanates from this city to the rest of the country and the world. We need the people here first and foremost on board.
How did you know Trump was going to win? Because you famously predicted this last summer, 2016, the summer of 2016.
I had too many people tell me in Michigan who had voted for Obama that they were going to vote for Trump. It was shocking at first. I mean, I'm like, are you kidding me? And some people voted for Obama twice. So I know all these people, they're not racist. They're not being drawn to Trump through that. You know, they're not misogynists. So what is going on here? Well, they're angry and upset. And they felt that the system had failed them, the Democratic Party had failed them, and they were going to toss a Molotov cocktail by the name of Donald J. Trump into the system and blow it. I heard that enough through the spring and summer. It was clear to me that he had an excellent chance of winning. Plus, his rallies were getting a lot more people, and the enthusiasm level. I think that's what I really noticed. I could tell that the people that were going to vote for Trump were going to bring 10 people to the polls with them.
Hmm.
The people voting for Hillary were kind of like, yeah, I'm going to vote for Hillary.
And you think he'll be reelected?
I think there's an excellent chance he'll be reelected because, again, elected by the Electoral College. We will get even a higher a popular vote in 2020. But that won't matter if he holds his base and if he holds these 3 Electoral College states that he won with, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. Too many liberals and Democrats right now are thinking, oh, no way, that can't happen. Don't forget, George W. Bush was a 2-term president. Nobody thought that was going to happen. This man can be a 2-term Trump, and you should live every day assuming that that's going to happen. And if that happens, If he goes to January of 2025, that's at least three more Supreme Court appointments. And then that's it for the rest of ours and our kids' lives.
Does this feel different to you than the Bush years when you were doing things like Fahrenheit 9/11?
That's a good question. Yes, it's different in this respect. When I spoke out against Bush and the Iraq war after the war started, I had very little support. I never could have, for instance, come to Broadway and been able to do this show. I mean, Bush had a 70% approval rating. The war had a 70% approval rating. Trump doesn't have that. So I now sense and feel that there's obviously a lot more people that I'm in agreement with and agree with me. And I guess one way it feels, it doesn't feel so lonely.
You say that you think that Trump is going to take the nation to war. Why do you think that?
Absolutely. I mean, he's so easy to read. He's easily distracted himself, and he easily distracts us. And he is going to need us to be distracted, because when and if any of those committees in Congress or Mueller's investigation bears any fruit, I fully expect him to either try taking us to war or doing that awful thing he did during the campaign when he would not ever once say he would accept the election results if he lost. He said, you know, if Hillary wins, I'm not quoting exactly, but something to the effect of he calls upon his Second Amendment people.
It's going to be rigged.
Yeah, it's going to be rigged. He kept saying that. And it was a code to say to his people, especially his armed followers, you know, be ready to go into the streets. If it looks like he's actually going to be removed while he's still president, that he will not go quietly.
You had a Q&A after the show, and somebody asked you a question about the media and the coverage of Trump, and said that the media shouldn't be covering Trump as much as they are. What do you think about that? I mean, he is the president of the United States, and I think a lot of people in the media feel they need to be covering him all the time, covering everything that he does.
I think it's important to cover. I wish the media would cover more of the things we don't know about, like what happened today in any of his federal agencies, little directives from mid-level managers that are going to end up costing us either huge sums of money or going to poison the environment or whatever that is. That's what I'd like to know. What I'd like, and I think what a lot of people would like the media to stop doing, is focusing so much on his nonsensical behavior and giving him that megaphone when he wants to go after Mika Brzezinski. That took up at least 2 days of everybody on the media just constantly talking about him attacking a morning host on MSNBC. I think that's what people are just sick and tired of. And we'd actually rather know the stuff we don't know for the media to actually dig more and do more. But that takes money, and that takes hardcore investigative reporting. That is the job we do need you to do.
One of the criticisms of you, and I've seen it about this show, is that you are saying things that people want to hear, but you make it about you. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I know. I'm the only one on the stage. So it's a little, it is true. I am the only one up there. I do have a couple people come out on the stage at the end, but generally I probably should have had 50 or 60 other characters on the stage, and it would have been less about me. If you're going to do a one man show, it's such an odd, I know it's, see, when I hear stuff like that, I know that nobody has any real criticism of what I'm saying, because what I'm saying is true. If all you can say is, you know what he's doing in his one-man show? It's all about one man. Bruce is going to be opening here down the street. Bruce Springsteen. He's going to do a one-man show. He's going to sing some songs and tell some stories from his life. I swear to God, you will never see anybody write, what's that Springsteen think he's doing? 2 hours and all it's yakety yak about Bruce.
Well, how did you decide, as you were putting this show together, what stories you wanted to tell about your life? There's a lot of stuff I had no idea about that you talked about.
Wanted to tell stories that showed how I learned, starting at an early age as a teenager, that one person can make a difference, and that that's not just a cliche. It really is true, and I experienced it. Starting at the age of 17, where something I did in Michigan made it on the CBS Evening News. And then the next year, I became one of the youngest people ever to be elected to office. When 18-year-olds are given the right to vote, a few months later, I got elected in Michigan. And I never would have thought that could have happened. I share these stories with the audience to say, and other people I've seen do things that have made huge changes in this world simply because they woke up one morning and said, damn it, I'm tired of this, or I'm going to do something about it. you know, as much as you're told that you're a nobody from nowhere, that is the biggest lie. You are actually somebody. You are from somewhere. And what you are is scary to those who run the show. Those in charge, the elite, you know, the upper whatever it is, the 1%, their biggest fear is that the 99% are going to realize they actually do hold the power.
Who do you think could beat Trump in 2020?
It would have to be a well-known, beloved American. I think we have to run TV against TV or run a movie star against Trump, the TV star. I know a lot of people listening to an NPR station probably go, oh, no, please, no, we need some, we need somebody.
Who, we need a radio host. Is we what need.
Well, yeah, radio host would be kind of, well, yes, Garrison Keillor.
Yeah, Terry Gross.
Or Terry Gross, right. Yes, absolutely. No, we need to run Tom Hanks. I want to run a beloved American that people are going to vote for. Oprah would win. Everybody knows Oprah would win. Michelle Obama would win. Oh, my God. She's not going to run. But that's the way Democrats need to start thinking. Not thinking about, you know, which wonky senator or representative or whatever. We got to think outside the mainstream of political people. I mean, first of all, Trump has proven anybody can get elected president. So if now we know that's the truth, we have a whole bunch of, we don't have to run just anybody. We could actually run somebody that could win.
Michael Moore, thank you so much for joining us.
And thank you. And thank you, NPR. We need you now more than ever.
We spoke last Thursday after Moore's Broadway show, The Terms of My Surrender, which runs until October 22nd. His next project will be a film called Fahrenheit 11-9, 11-9 being the date when President Trump declared victory in the last election.
Puerto Rico has been devastated by Maria. Parts of Florida are still recovering from Irma. Las Vegas, of course, has just been traumatized by a mass shooting. But one month on, Texas is still recovering from Hurricane Harvey, with many hospitals in southeastern Texas still feeling the impact. Max Blau is the Southern correspondent with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, and he joins us by Skype. Max, start with evacuations.
In the week after Harvey hit the Houston area as well as southeast Texas, nearly two dozen hospitals had to evacuate patients, either partially or closing down hospitals entirely. And during that time, even more hospitals had to cancel surgeries and some had to shut down for days in the midst of the flooding that came after Harvey.
So hospitals also had to do some repair from water damage. So they didn't have patients for a while. And they had patients, for instance, with elective surgeries, things like hip and knee replacements, that they sent away when they had to take in the more seriously ill. What's the financial impact of that?
So it is early to really put a hard number on the overall estimate of what was lost in terms of elective surgeries being postponed or canceled. But talking with one hospital in Beaumont, Texas, an administrator there described to me a scenario where if someone has $4,000 worth of flooding damage in their house, there's a chance they're going to take care of that first before getting the surgery that they need, but they don't need right away. It's not the priority anymore as people are caring for the things they need to go on with their lives sooner.
Well, and these high-paying elective surgeries are what keep hospitals going because they are so high paying, as opposed to the very low income people who might be coming in for help now who don't have coverage. And Texas is one of those states. You spoke to a health economist from Rice University who pointed out that Texas did not take the federal funds for expanding Medicaid. So how is that impacting the hospitals now as they lose the high paying elective surgeries, but have more and more patients coming in who may not have coverage?
The healthcare economist I spoke with had concerns that this would be another road bump on top of a series of them, financially speaking, that have affected safety net hospitals in Texas. In particular, as more and more people are facing substantial damage to their homes and are having to, they may have had health insurance, but now they have thousands of dollars of other financial needs that they have to take care of, that some might be even foregoing insurance at this point in time and making those payments.
You're talking about those who might be able to purchase insurance. I'm not talking about, you know, Medicaid, but those who might be able to purchase insurance but just won't because of all the other expenditures they have.
Exactly. And what that means for safety net hospitals, whose missions are often ones based around giving care to whoever needs it, regardless of their ability to pay for it, and often receive public funding to help support that mission, is that they are taking on more and more people who can't afford it at this point in time. And while they are always expecting to provide uncompensated care of some variety, they are also businesses that have a bottom line. And the more that they provide free care, the more that that's going to strain their efforts to stay afloat and to not close down their doors or anything else like that.
That's Max Blau, Southern correspondent with STAT, talking about how hospitals are still recovering from Harvey in the Houston area. Max, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for some music and a German edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
Du hast mich.
Sie ist ein Model und sie sieht gut aus.
99 Luftballons, ihrem Weg zum Horizont geht man zu Ufer.
Arndt Heltner is DJ and host of the syndicated weekly show Radio Goethe, which is produced at KUSF in San Francisco and features music from Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Arndt, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And before we get to the music, just tell us about your radio show. You started this after you moved to the U.S. from Germany 20 years ago?
Yeah, I moved here in 1996, and shortly after I realized I'm missing German music, so I wanted to put a show on the air. And I found in the college radio station here in San Francisco a good partner. They broadcast some old German classic like Kraftwerk, Faust, Amon Dülken, the old krautrock stuff. And so I thought like it would be interesting maybe to put a show on the air with like more modern stuff and spanning the time frame from the early 70s to today.
And have you found a good audience for that?
Oh, yes. I found a great audience, actually. People are really interested in music beyond the United States, beyond the borders. And I was very lucky at this point because like two things happened. The internet broke, so I got response from all around the country. And the second thing is that the most famous German band, Rammstein, broke with Lost Highway, this film. And so a lot of people were looking for it.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing some of the music. And in this case, because I took French and Spanish throughout my life and not German, I'm going to have you introduce these songs because some of them are rather difficult to say. So let's get to the first one. Tell us what it is.
The first one is by a band from Berlin called Infamous, and the song is called A Ganz Großes Kino.
Ist alles andere, auch Bäume sind dabei. Und dann krallen sie sich ineinander vorbei. Hinter der Schönheit der Bewusstlosigkeit hat sich das Ende in den Anfang verliebt. Liebe, Heimat, Mord, flanieren vorbei. Flucht und Leid und Frieden, es scheint. Bis aus dem Dunkel einer Weglosigkeit ein letzter Schuss hat, hat man alles gesehen.
It sounds pretty dark. Tell us about this one.
They are pretty dark. They were what's called like the Metropolitan Cowboys from Berlin. They use a sound between like Johnny Cash and Nick Cave. So this is kind of like their background, musical background. And they come from East Berlin, actually, when the GDR was still there. They all grew up in East Germany. And I met them in the mid-90s. And I really liked them. The beginning, they were singing in English, and then they switched to German. And I really liked them more in German because like their lyrics are kind of dark, kind of like very philosophical sometimes. So I really enjoy them.
And why did you choose this song in particular?
Oh, this is actually a story that kind of like success story of my little Radio Goethe show here. I met Wim Wenders in San Francisco one time for an interview, and I really like his movie. So I gave him a CD, and he listened to this album after a while and contacted the band, ordered all their albums, and then finally said, like, look, we should do something together. And he put out the latest album, Im Westen der Himmel, on his own label as a second album at all.
Okay, what is the next song?
The next song is by a band called the Einstürzenden Neubauten. That means collapsing new buildings. They have been around since the late 70s, early 80s. It's a Berlin band. They started out as an industrial punk band, but the song is called Die Wellen from the album Alles wieder offen.
Beständig nur ist eure Unbeständigkeit. Siegreich letztendlich, denn sie hüllt wie oft beschworen Steine. Malt den Sand so fein wie Stundengläser, Eieruhren ihn brauchen, zum Zeitvermessen und für den Unterschied von hart und weich. Siegreich auch, weil niemals müde, den Wettbewerb, wer von uns beiden zuerst im Schlaf versinkt, gewinnt ihr oder du das Meer noch immer, weil du niemals schläfst.
Wow, what is he saying?
Sometimes the lyrics don't really add up. I think you just have to get them kind of like on you in some ways. But this is it's a great band. It's a very influential band with their approach to music, because for them it's kind of like this Dadaistic idea that music can be done with everything. When they came to tour in the United States, they started in San Francisco. One part of the group picked up their luggage from the airport. The other part of the group went right away to a junkyard and picked out their instruments, because they use instruments like metal sheets and everything and bang around it. So if you have a chance to see them live, you should do this. It's really, really eye candy, perfect.
And do they come to the United States often?
They come quite often. The last tour was canceled last minute because they didn't get like visas for their tour, what they need there. But they have been here for quite some time.
Okay, well, next we're going to take it in another direction. This is a song that I can actually pronounce. This is called Heart Moon, and it's by the Nuremberg-based group Shiny Gnomes.
Heart Moon.
So some sitar there, English lyrics. Tell us about this song.
I mean, I had to pick a band from my hometown, Nuremberg, and I'm very proud of this band. And what I really like about this, they are open to a lot of different influences in the German music scene. And I think you can clearly hear this borders a little bit on world music also, what kind of elements they put in there. So I really like this song, and I really like to play it very loud when I'm driving a car at night, because it's really a fantastic trip.
And is it rare for a German band to sing in English?
No, not at all. I mean, when I grew up, there was most bands sing in English. I mean, just think about the Scorpions. They were the leading band in Germany, and they were singing in English. And I think it started to change a little bit in the early 90s, when finally German hip-hop bands realized they can say much better what they wanted to say in their own language than in English. So there was a huge switch from English to German. And so right now I would say like it's probably 60 to 40%, where 60% are singing in German, 40% still in English.
This is why I can get away with not speaking German, because even when I've been to Germany, everybody speaks English.
So, I know.
That's, or at least they know how to speak English. They don't speak it to each other. We have time for one more. This one is not German. This is a band from Niger called Studio Shap Shap and their song Peau de Chèvre. So why did you choose this one?
This song I picked because actually I'm working as a correspondent and I visited Niger and I travel quite often to conflict and post-conflict areas. So I was in Niamey and this band invited me to their rehearsal and I saw them and then realized like music is such a universal language there. I mean, there was only one woman there who spoke English with me. The other musicians, they talked in local languages. I didn't have any idea what they were saying and what they were singing. But we just like shared this moment in some ways. We were smiling at each other. We shared a drink together and it was really like some very peaceful moment there. And this is like my basic idea with Radio Goethe, that people are open to an international sound and just try to see like different cultures through music and then are open to this.
Well, thank you for bringing some of it to us today. Arndt Peltner, DJ and host of the weekly show Radio Goethe, which is produced at KUSF in San Francisco. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can find a link to this music and all of our DJ sessions at hereandnow.org.
We've heard voices for and against NFL players taking a knee during the anthem to protest injustice and show unity. But a researcher who's been surveying Trump voters found the reasons against the move are varied. Diane Hessen founded the research company C-Space. She joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Robin.
So give us the number one reason that you heard from Trump voters that they didn't support the taking of the knee.
It's just plain patriotism. I mean, I think it's less people concerned about the overall cause and more people saying, is this how you have to protest? A cherished ritual in this country that brings people together. For many people, a sacred place where you root for your team, but people of all political persuasions root for their team.
Well, you've said two things there. It's a cherished ritual, which for them is football, and you say it's like yoga. You wouldn't want somebody to suddenly protest during your yoga class, but also it's what we've heard, the flag, the anthem, which represents the military sacrifice. You have Deborah from New Hampshire. She wants the president to use words like despicable and disgrace to describe things like that Ravens-Jaguars game in London where the American players took a knee for the national anthem but stood for God Save the Queen.
Absolutely. I mean, what Deborah in New Hampshire said is that she feels like that just, made a mockery of our entire nation.
Let's go to some of the other reasons, though. Okay. The NFL leaders' hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. The Trump supporters you spoke with asked why they didn't step in other cases, such as?
Last July, the Dallas Cowboys wanted to do something to signify their support for these five police officers who were shot dead. They had these decals that they wore on their helmets. They wore them during practice. And then the NFL stepped in and banned the idea.
Right.
The question, really, the hypocrisy is, why did Roger Goodell say it was okay for players to take a knee, but not okay for players to wear a fairly benign decal
right.
supporting Dallas police?
Look, the third reason we've also heard voices saying this, that liberals celebrate free speech when it comes to their issues, but not when it comes to conservatives, and they point to issues on college campuses.
You know, most recently, Jeff Sessions at Georgetown. You know, Ann Coulter coming out and doing a speech. You know, people protesting that. Mm-hmm. You know, you protest when you don't like the cause.
Well, and another reason, they don't trust the players. And this is so interesting because these are football fans, these Trump voters. Mm-hmm. And they ask, why didn't the players protest domestic violence when Ray Rice sucker punched his girlfriend in that elevator video that came out? Mm-hmm. These fans ask whether or not these football players, you know, if their heart is in the right place, they really question why don't they go back to their own neighborhoods, you've heard people say.
Mm-hmm.
These are largely African-American players. Many mm-hmm. have come up from tough circumstances. And these people are asking, why aren't they going to their neighborhoods and maybe helping those in need? You pointed out many players are, but President Trump, you know, people have asked, why did he do this? It was just an Alabama rally for a losing candidate. And you say there's something else going on here for the president.
Well, yes, Robin. You know, you think about people screaming that these players should go back to their neighborhoods. And I think lots of progressives will say, well, there you have it. It's just one more example of racism. When I really probe with people, it seems broader than that. it's almost like a class war, because what they call the players are millionaires.
Yeah.
Look at these millionaires who used to understand what it was like to be needy, who now have completely lost touch with middle America and don't even know how to do the right thing for a cause that everyone cares about.
The flag.
Trump knows that if he stokes anything related to identity politics, that the Democrats will jump onto it. It's almost like a trap. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, we've got a week of people screaming and yelling about civil rights. And he knows how to not just distract attention from other places where he's had trouble, but he knows how to literally change what the media is saying and what his liberal opponents are saying about the most important issues of the day.
Because this is what matters most to many of the Trump voters, this sense of us versus them, and there is a divide. But how fascinating that in this case, it might be football fans against football players that they perceive now as being part of the elite.
Absolutely. Look, here's the main narrative for a Trump voter. I'm trying to make ends meet. I play by the rules. I have big issues related to jobs and taxes and other things that are day-to-day issues for me. And all of you liberals are complaining about transgender bathrooms. That narrative gets reinforced every single time the president says things like, you shouldn't take a knee because of the anthem. It's all the same theme.
That's Diane Hessen. Her company is C-Space. But she has spent the last 10 months doing research with over 400 voters. 50% of them are Trump voters. 40% of those 400 are in favor of President Trump's criticism of football players taking the knee. And we just heard why. Diane, thank you.
My pleasure.
And your thoughts are welcome at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.